Atonement pictures different things, but it pictures the binding of Satan and also the atoning sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And because we talk about the Passover and the sacrifice of Christ in the spring, I'm the one that gives the sermon, so most of the time I think I lean a little more towards speaking about the binding of Satan in atonement itself. But again, there's two goats. Paul and I were talking on the way back, you know, there's the goat that is relieved, let in the wilderness and bears the sin of his responsibility for the impact he's had, but the sacrifice, the goat that was killed, was portrayed by Jesus Christ. But sometimes we think once you get that goat and you let him go and he's out in the wilderness, you know, once Satan is bound and put away, then we can finally be at peace. And the honest answer is that's not really true. We are at peace only when we are without sin, and sin only comes remission of sin by the sacrifice of Christ. But I want to portray a little bit what it'd be like then if we take Satan out of the way and look at how the world plays in that sense, because again, in our mind, I think we look at the millennium and we see the peace and the safety and the prosperity of the millennium. But there's another thread that runs through the middle of the millennium that's not as obvious. And Satan is gone, so we can't say, well, the devil made him do it, because it's over. The people at the beginning of the millennium walk into it from this world, and so they carry Satan's influence with them. But as that influence is slowly dispersed and removed and washed away, even by experience, then there's still a thread that carries through, and I'd like to illustrate that for you today. It is important to understand that we are fully able to sin by ourselves. We have everything we need to sin without Satan being involved. Zechariah 14 is the beginning of the millennium, and we've read it before in terms of the keeping of the Feast of Tabernacles in verse 16. But it says, "It'll come to pass that everyone who's left of all the nations which came up against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain. As the family of Egypt does not come up and enter in, they will have no rain." It says this is the plague in which God will punish those who do not come before him to keep the feast. Now, if you're looking at Israel being the center of where God sets up his kingdom, and it goes out from there, then the possibility that Egypt right next door in the beginning might not be obedient. So God's kingdom has to go out from where it begins and begin to envelop the kingdoms of the earth one by one as it is expressed. Now in the book of Micah, there is another one that kind of shows the desire from the other side. As people begin to look to Jerusalem and see God's presence and his kingdom being set up, and then they want to come in and to worship before God. But in Micah 4, it says, "It'll come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills. And people shall flow to it. Many nations shall come and say, Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways. We shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion the law shall go forth, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." And it says, he'll judge between peoples. He'll rebuke those peoples who, it says, are afar off. They'll turn their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks, and nation will not lift up sword against nation, neither will they learn war anymore. These are the physical people. And it says, let's go up. Let's go up to the mountain of the Lord. Let's go up to Jerusalem and learn from God. And so the impact of God's presence and his kingdom goes out bit by bit until, as in we see in the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 2, we have the image, the image of the head of gold, and it's a portrayed here and explained by Daniel. But Daniel 2:31, as Daniel is explaining to the king, he says, "O king, you were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. The image's head was of fine gold, chest and arms of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And you watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. This world system is destroyed. Satan's system is destroyed, and he is bound and put away. Then the iron, clay, the bronze, the silver, and gold were crushed together, became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found." You can destroy the actual political structure of the kingdom, but the people who come into the millennium are going to carry that memory still with them, so it takes time to blow away all of that chaff. But it says, "The stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." So the filling is a process. It takes time. Habakkuk says the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord. But it's interesting. It says it'll be filled with the knowledge. Jeremiah 31, God says, "I will pour out my spirit on all of mankind." God's spirit will fill the earth. And I think in the back of our mind, sometimes we think, well, you know what? Satan is bound, he's put away, and peace now is going to break out on the earth, and everyone is going to be worshiping God as God's impact and as his presence is expanded and felt. And you know, it doesn't really say that. It doesn't actually say that all of the people during the millennium are even going to be converted. It doesn't say that they're all going to buy in to what God has offered. See, that the scriptures on the millennium portray peace, abundance, prosperity, blessings, healing. There's no sickness, disease, a great abundant harvest. That's the focus. And that's what God is wanting to put forth as representing what his kingdom will be doing in those days. But the fact is, there's still a thread running through the millennium that is the recognition that we have a choice to make, that we are responsible for the things that we do. And you can take Satan and remove him completely. He will not be there for 1,000 years, and people will still continue to sin. As long as they live in this flesh, they will continue to sin. They will continue to be self-willed and be self-driven and deciding for themselves, even in the midst of all of God's presence. Just binding Satan does not remove sin. It takes the atoning sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Ecclesiastes 7, Solomon comments on his perspective as he has looked at man and what man is like. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 27. Well, let's see, excuse me, one more book. One less book. He says, "Here's what I've found," says the preacher, adding one thing to the other to find out the reason. He says, "I've thought through it. I've looked at everything." He says, "Which my soul still seeks, but I cannot find. A man among 1,000 I have found, but a woman among all these I have not found." That's not flattering for either side. It's not a positive statement on either end. "Truly this only I have found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes." Man has chosen to go this way. God made him upright, started him out straight. Man did not need Satan to turn aside. Now, Satan certainly has been used of God or allowed by God to fulfill his plan. You know, the calling of the first fruits is a very high calling. You do not see the people of the millennium being described as the first fruits. The great white throne judgment is the latter harvest. The first fruits are a very high and special calling, and they pay, in that sense, a little higher price. They do. We have to swim against the current of evil in a different way than other people will be required to, either in the millennium or in the great white throne judgment. I believe that reward is higher. It is a remarkable difference. But again, the symbolism of what God is doing is still here in place for us to see. But we do not need Satan to sin. When Satan is put away, then people will live into the millennium. And again, you'll see a little thread that follows through in response. Look at the way David described himself in Psalm 51 when he was coming to repentance and crying out to God. Verse number 5, David said, "I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me." He's not saying the act of his conception was a sin. That's not the point. We know that's not true. He's just saying, I have begun in sin. I have lived in sin. It infuses me. And he asked God to clean him, to cleanse him, to give him a new heart. Again, the atoning sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Back in the book of Genesis, chapter 3, we see the sin of Adam and Eve. And in verse number 6, it says, "The woman saw," Genesis 3:6, "the tree was good for food." All right, is there something sinful about recognizing that a tree is good for food? Not really. It was pleasant to the eyes. If you see something that's pleasant to the eyes, is that sinful? Not necessarily. "And it was a tree desirable to make one wise." Is that a sin? Not necessarily. The sin was God said, don't do it. And so then what we have in 1 John described as the lust of the flesh as compared to just the desire, and the lust of the eyes as compared to just the desire, and the pride of life, that is sin. And with or without Satan, we have those things. We have the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life all by ourselves. Satan's kind of the accelerant on the explosion, so to speak. You can, I at home, we're coming up to winter, and then when winter comes, I'll light a fire in the stove, and I'll take some paper, put it in there, I'll put some wood in there, and light a match. And 3 out of 4 times, I'm going to have to get down on my hands and knees and then blow on it, because it just didn't quite catch fire. Now, the paper's good enough to start, the wood's good enough to start, the match is enough to do the job, but the fact is, Satan is the one, effectively, that blows on the sin to ignite it. And he adds that element, that pressure, that concentration, and that's what Satan does. He wants us destroyed. But the fact is, even without him, we could still sin all on our own. And we need to take ownership of that, recognize what our nature is, and that we need the atoning sacrifice of Jesus Christ, and that there is no other way. Going back here to Zechariah 14, I think it's interesting, when you walk into the millennium and you go back, we talk about keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, but there's another element that comes into play in verse number 20. Zechariah 14, verse 20. It says, "In that day, holiness to the Lord shall be engraved on the bells of the horses. The pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yes, every pot in Jerusalem and Judah shall be holiness to the Lord of hosts, and everyone who sacrifices shall come and take them and cook in them. And that day there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts." Said in God's house, in his temple, there'll be nothing that defiles. But the people in the millennium are going to be sacrificing physical sacrifices in a physical temple before God. The priests will do so. You know, it is fascinating. In the Old Testament, you had a physical temple, and you had a physical people, and physical sacrifices. In the millennium, you're going to have a physical temple, physical priesthood, and physical sacrifices. Now, in our time now today, who's the temple? We're the temple. And we are a spiritual priesthood, and we offer spiritual sacrifices. Is that not a high calling? Is that not a remarkable calling where God would use us as his temple? But he shows going into the millennium that he's going to have the physical temple actually reestablished, and he's going to begin to have sacrifices offered again at that time. I think it's important for us to understand what the purpose of that would be. The book of Ezekiel, I mentioned in my trumpet sermon, Ezekiel wrote from the captivity of Babylon in the captivity of the Jews, one of the early stages of the Jewish captivity. And he wrote after Israel had already gone to Assyria 125 years before. And yet the message says, write to the house of Israel, my people. But they were gone, and they did not come back. You know, if a few came back, that doesn't represent the nation. Israel did not return. So when you go through the book of Ezekiel, you will find many things. Well, this looks historical. This seems very physical and specific. But the honest answer is that most of the symbolism in the book of Ezekiel is for the end time, is for the last days. And when you get into the last chapters, 40 through 48, and you have some very physical explanation, it is applying directly to the time of the millennium then as well. Ezekiel 37, Valley of Dry Bones, Great White Throne Judgment. Ezekiel 38, 39, you have Gog and all of their allies and how they are destroyed. You have Israel being restored to their land and God's Spirit being poured out. Now, again, there's so much there that is for the last days as compared to just historical events of that time. But look at Ezekiel 40. I want to just start out at the beginning. I want to show you some of the elements of the temple that is being described, the sacrifices that are being portrayed, and then the reason, at least in part, for them. I think we'll understand fully another day, but we can certainly understand what God reveals to us at this time. Ezekiel 40, verse 1, says, in the 25th year of our captivity, at the beginning of the year, in the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was captured, on the very same day, the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he took me there. And in vision, so this is a vision that God gave to Ezekiel, he took me into a land of Israel and set me on a very high mountain. On it toward the south was something like the structure of a city. And what's going to be portrayed here is the temple in the millennium, there at God's center of his kingdom and where God's authority goes out from here. He took me there, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of bronze. He had a line of flax and a measuring rod in his hand, and he stood in the gateway. And the man said to me, Son of man, look with your eyes and hear with your ears and fix in your mind on everything I show you. For you were brought here so that I might show them to you. Declare to the house of Israel everything you see. We're not talking historical Israel here. They were in captivity and gone. We are talking the house of Israel down into this time. We're talking to the house of Israel at the beginning of the millennium. And the record now is going to be made to give them many, many details about many things. And again, Ezekiel explains, at least in part, why that must be. Verse number 38, going down a little further, says, there was a chamber and its entrance by the gateposts of the gateway where they washed the burnt offering. The vestibule of the gateway, in there were two tables on this side, two tables on that side, with which to slay the burnt offering, the sin offering, and the trespass offering. Now, it goes into great detail, and it shows where the gates are and the tables and how the structure was built and where the rooms were that were used in various ways. Verse 41, four tables were on this side, four tables on that side by the side of the gateway. 8 tables on which they slaughtered the sacrifices. There were also 4 tables of hewn stone for the burnt offering, a cubit and a half long, a cubit and a half wide, and a cubit high. On these they laid the instruments with which they slaughtered the burnt offering and the sacrifice. And then it says the flesh of the sacrifices was on the tables. So there's incredible detail here and very specific, and the book later on explains why so much detail and what it would need to be. Now, the question that came to me, frankly, just this last week as well, I've heard it before, the question is, well, why would there be sacrifices during the millennium? Why would there be sacrifices anyway? And you know, I don't think I can answer that for you 100%, but I can answer it for you some. Look at Hebrews 10. Let's make a distinction between which sacrifices that we're referring to and what they represent, what they mean. Hebrews 10, verse number 11, says, every priest stands ministering daily and offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. Physical sacrifice does not take away sin. But this man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down at the right hand of God. It does not say that sacrifices would cease forever. He offered one sacrifice for sin forever. There's a little bit of a difference in those two things. From that time waiting till his enemies are made his footstool. It says, and for by one offering he has perfected forever those who are being sanctified. Now, go back to verse 1 of chapter 10. It says, for the law, having a shadow of the good things to come and not the very image of the things, can never with these same sacrifices which they offer continually, year by year, make those who approach perfect. The sacrifice that made perfect was the sacrifice of Christ. That's not what physical sacrifices were supposed to do. For then they would not have ceased, would they not have ceased to be offered? For the worshippers, once purged, would have had no more consciousness of sins. But in those sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins every year. It is not possible the blood of bulls and goats could take away sins. Physical sacrifices are to remind us of sin. They're to show us in various ways what the penalty of sin would be in a more physical means. And we're supposed to walk through in various ways those who gave the sacrifice. I say we will be spirit beings, but we have those in the millennium and those in the Old Testament. They had to do the rituals to show and portray what was clean and what was unclean and what was pure and what was impure. And so God gave them washings and ceremonies to imprint in their mind the consequence of sin. Physical sacrifices are to remind us of sin. Christ's sacrifice is the atonement for our sin. Those are not the same thing. And again, there will be sacrifices again. Again, you think about the millennium now. And in the millennium, it might be easy to, at some point in time, kind of forget that sin really exists the way it once did. You know, everything's in bloom and blossom. The deserts have springs. The dry lands have now crops that are growing. It says the plowman will overtake the reaper. If you can try to imagine getting out of the way, reaping in time before the plow comes behind you and starts again. I mean, it's just amazing what is portrayed. It says the ruins and the waste places are going to be rebuilt. Children playing in the streets, young boys and girls playing in the streets of Jerusalem. Families there, old men and women that are there, sitting there in their age and watching the children, enjoying the blessing of being together. You know, the nations beat their swords into plowshares. Man does not learn war anymore. At some point in the millennium, it's going to be just like Adam and Eve were in the garden before Satan existed. It's going to be the Eden is being restored, and it'll be the millennium. And at some point in time, it's going to be like, well, you know, where's that sin anyway? Why, we have everything. We're happy. We're together. We're blessed. We're healthy. There's no sickness. There's no trauma. Nothing can hurt and destroy. We're being protected. And it would be at the point where at some point you just wouldn't be paying attention anymore, just exactly what sin really is. And yet sin never goes away in this flesh, does it? Never in this flesh. You cannot take away Satan and also take away sin. Because sin is, David said, I was born in iniquity. It's been everything I've been all my life. Cleanse me, God. Cleanse me of these iniquities. So let's go back to Ezekiel again and see a little bit of the illustration of what the lesson was that Israel will have to learn during the millennium to be reminded of the consequence of these things. Go back to Ezekiel 40. And I want to go just a verse further in verse 5 of the first chapter than I did before. It says, now there was a wall all around the outside of the temple. This is in the millennium. There's a wall around the temple. And it's a big one. It's a big wall. It says, in a man's hand was a measuring rod 6 cubits long, each being a cubit and a handbreadth. Now, a cubit, there's different lengths of cubits, but the cubit's basically the forearm, and here it says a cubit and a handbreadth, so it's about this much distance, and it says 6 of those was a rod. So you're looking at probably nothing less than 10 feet. Some of the measurements of cubits that are recorded have been more like 16 feet, but again, I'm not an expert on the measurements, but this is a rod. It says, he measured the width of the wall structure. It was one rod. Let's say it was 10 foot thick, and the height was one rod. It was 10 foot tall. Now, why do you build a wall 10 foot tall? Why would you do that? What's a wall for, anyway? It's to keep people out. There are no wild animals, right? There, you know, the lion's eating grass, you know, and the snakes don't bite anybody and cause any trouble. And so you got a wall around the temple. And a wall is to separate. In the temple of the New Testament, which was from Solomon's time, but they had the wall of division between the Gentiles and the Israelites, and the Gentiles could not pass that wall. That was just a short wall. It was more of a just don't pass this one. This is 10 feet tall. So we have around this temple in the millennium a wall. Now, verse chapter 42 and verse number 13, he said to me, again, I'm illustrating certain points of the temple and the way it's described because I'm trying to make a specific point. I'm certainly not going to do an exegesis of all 9 chapters here, and frankly, I don't think I could. But he said to me in verse 13, the north chambers and the south chambers, which are opposite the separating courtyard, are the holy chambers where the priests who approach the Lord shall eat the most holy offerings. There they shall lay the most holy offering, the grain offering, the sin offering, the trespass offering, for the place is holy. And so the description is now being made on, there's different levels of how close you can get to the where God's throne is going to be. And there's barriers to that. And no one who's impure or unholy is going to enter in. It says, when the priests enter them, they'll not go out of the holy chamber into the outer court. There they shall leave their garments in which they minister, for they are holy. And they shall put on other garments that they may approach that which is for the people. You're going to have people who still are in their sin. There are people who are unconverted, people who are submitting to God visibly but not in their heart, people that are still rebelling in various ways. That's a process that is put down as God's government is increased. Verse 15 says, when he had finished measuring the inner temple, he brought me out to the gateway that faces toward the east, and he measured it around. And verse 20, he measured it on the 4 sides. It had a wall all around, 500 cubits long, 500 cubits wide, to separate the holy areas from the common. The wall was to keep the common things out of the holy place. Now, common, in that sense, portrays sin. It has not been made holy, God's presence. It's not been cleansed. It's not been purified. You have a physical existence during the millennium that includes sin. People's lives will continue to include sin. And God says that cannot be in my presence, and I will not be in the midst of that in that way. So we then go forward, maybe chapter 43. Let's go a little further down. So there's no question about what is being portrayed here, though. Verse 5 says, "The Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court. And behold, the glory of the Lord filled the temple. I heard him speaking to me from the temple while a man stood beside me. And he said to me, 'Son of man, this is the place of my throne, the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever. No more shall the house of Israel defile my holy name, nor their kings by their harlotry or with the carcasses of their kings on their high places. When they set their threshold in my threshold and their doorpost by my doorpost, with a wall between me and them, they defiled my holy name by the abominations which they committed. Therefore I have consumed them in my anger.'" They would place themselves in God's presence, in his presence by his temple, and commit abominations and harlotry. And God says, "I consumed them in my anger. Let them put their harlotry and the carcasses of their kings far away from me, and I will dwell in the midst forever." We're clearly in the millennium here. This is not ancient Israel. "Son of man, describe the temple to the house of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure the pattern. God has not here given us the explanation of each part of the pattern. He's going to give that to Israel. And he's going to use it to explain to them the consequence of sin. It says, let them be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure the pattern. And if they're ashamed of all that they have done," that means sin, "and make known to them the design of the temple, its arrangement, its exit, its entrances, its entire design, all its ordinances, all the forms, all of its laws, write it down in their sight, so that they may keep its whole design and all of its ordinances and perform them. This is the law of the temple. The whole area surrounding the mountaintop shall be most holy. Behold, this is the law of the temple." So those answers are not all given to us at this time. But it's saying that everything about it, all the ceremonies, the structure, the measurements, the sacrifices, the way the sacrifices are prepared, the washings, the garments of the priests, all of it portrays, on the one hand, righteousness by doing God's will, and common or sin, on the other hand, if you're outside of that and you have not complied or put these things in place. So God's going to teach his people in the millennium the consequence of sin, in part the way he taught Israel in the Old Testament the consequence of sin, through the temple system. And they're going to be a physical people again, and God is going to do it, as he says here, in this way. Chapter 44 and verse number 9, "Thus says the Lord God, no foreigner, uncircumcised in heart or uncircumcised in flesh," circumcision is going to be reestablished, "shall enter my sanctuary, including any foreigner who is among the children of Israel." It says right here that in the millennium there are going to be people who are uncircumcised in heart, unconverted, and unresponsive to God during the millennium, and God says they're not going to enter in. And he put a wall up to make sure that they would not come across in an improper way, and there will be certainly protection and guards at the gates. God's presence will be respected, and he will teach his people the difference between the holy and the profane. through the priesthood, through his teachers. Verse 21 of chapter 44, no priest shall drink wine when he enters the inner court. They shall not take as wife a widow or a divorced woman, but take virgins of the descendants of the house of Israel or the widows of priests. Sounds a lot like the Old Testament, doesn't it? Sounds a lot like some of the specific instructions that were given there. They shall teach my people the difference between the holy and the unholy, cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean. In controversy they will stand as judges and judge it according to my judgments. They shall keep my laws and my statutes and all my appointed meetings. They shall hallow my Sabbaths. They shall not defile themselves by coming near a dead person. Only for father, mother, son or daughter, brother, unmarried sister may they defile themselves. And it just goes on. It begins to describe here how God is working and what he wants. What he wants is for them to offer to him the best, because what it represents. Verse 30, the best of all firstfruits of any kind and every sacrifice of any kind from all your sacrifices shall be the priest's. And you shall give to the priest the first of your ground meal to cause a blessing to rest on your house. So the description, again, it goes on and it expands. Sacrifices during the millennium are going to do what sacrifices during the Old Testament did. They will be a reminder of sin. Now, Isaiah 11, being one of our favorite millennial scriptures, lion and the lamb and a little child shall lead them. Start in verse number 6. The wolf will dwell with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the young goat, the calf, the young lion, the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young ones shall lie down together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole, and a weaned child shall put his hand in the viper's den. Again, it says, they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. It says it will be full of the knowledge of the Lord. It doesn't say everybody's going to be converted. It doesn't say everyone's going to be happily, willingly obedient. It doesn't say that they're all going to be circumcised of heart. We've already read that they're not all going to be circumcised of heart. So what happens to a person when someone has authority, God, and he establishes kingdom, and he rules over his kingdom, then the people who that rule is over have to submit. Because they submit, does that mean that their heart is now circumcised and that they are pure? Doesn't mean that at all. And again, I will show you some of that. There will be peace because God will enforce it. That is not the same as everyone will be going God's way. Psalm 72 is one verse, and verse number 8. My Bible right here says, the glory and universality of the Messiah's reign. And I think it's reasonably accurate there, but Psalm 72 and verse number 8. He shall have dominion also from sea to sea, from the river to the ends of the earth. Those who dwell in the wilderness will bow before him, and his enemies will lick the dust. It says his enemies will bow before him in the millennium under God's kingdom. Kings of Tarshish in the isles will bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba will offer gifts. All kings shall fall down before him, and nations shall serve him. Don't confuse falling down before God and serving God as conversion and being filled with the Spirit. I think in my mind, I equated those things over the years. I just assumed, well, they bow down before God. Well, that would be like a person who's worshiping God sincerely. No. If you're powerful, and you have control, and you require them, they will bow down. And again, we've seen scripture that shows, well, everyone, you know, isn't going to be clean. Everyone isn't going to be circumcised of heart. There are going to be people, quite frankly, who are enemies. as it quotes right here, and the enemies, it said, will lick the dust. Now, they're not friends, they're not part of God's family, they're not part of his kingdom. They're bowing down, though, because they have no choice. Psalm 110 is a different scripture, addresses it just slightly differently. But this is David, he said, writing this. He said, the Lord said to my Lord, Psalm 110, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. They're enemies, and they have to bow down and get down and submit themselves. The Lord shall send the rod of your strength out of Zion. Rule in the midst of your enemies. This is a messianic prophecy of the kingdom of God in the millennium. And it says, you rule with what? A rod. Rod of what? Rod of iron. A rod of iron is not how you make close friendly relations. A rod of iron is authority. And the word here is enemies. And those who must bow down sometimes, quite frankly, are not friends. And you do have peace because God enforces it. That is a description in part of the millennium. Now, Revelation 2 is a promise to the church, and it is also a reference to, it's quoted in the reference to Jesus Christ, but it's a promise to the church and part that the church will have in this. Revelation 2 and verse 26. He who overcomes and keeps my works unto the end, to him I will give power over the nations. He will rule them with a rod of iron. This is Jesus Christ, and it's quoted now in promise in reference to those who overcome, as the potter's vessel will be broken to pieces. So we're going to be given power over the nations to enforce them to not learn war anymore. We're going to require them to beat their swords into plowshares. We're going to demand of them that they will bow down and humble themselves and be at peace. Now, many of those people will say, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord. Let us worship. There will certainly be an abundance of those who respond when God's Spirit is poured out on the earth. But it doesn't mean everybody is going to do that. Everyone is not going to respond in the same way. Some people are, quite frankly, simply going to submit. And that's as far as it will be. They will simply submit. And it gives the abundance. It gives the appearance of peace. You take away Satan, sin is not gone. Sin is still in place. The lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, the pride of life, we own that ourselves. And Satan can fan that into flames, but we can do it all by ourselves on our own. And Satan in the millennium will not be there. And sin amongst those who live on the earth will still exist. Revelation 20. It makes a little more sense to me in Revelation 20 now, in verse number 7. If I think in terms of the fact that everyone on the earth is not converted, everyone on the earth is not worshiping God in heart, but there are those, quite frankly, that have simply had to endure God's rule through the millennium, and they had no choice but to submit. You see, even the angels, a third of the angels, didn't stay faithful to God. It's not like the natural course is to turn and everyone obey. The natural course is that everyone will not obey. Verse 7 of Revelation 20, when the 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison, and he will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle whose number is as the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet were, and they'll be tormented day and night forever. They, again, the beast, the false prophet, burn up. The torment is the angel, Satan and his angels, his demons. They'll be thinking and remembering, and they will be cast aside and restrained. Why can Satan so easily go out into 1,000 years of perfect rule by God and raise up a massive rebellion like the sand of the sea of people to turn and rebel against him. Well, some of those people would probably be like the angels. They were pure, they were perfect, and then they chose another way. But the fact is, everyone out here in the millennium isn't converted anyway. And there are always people that are waiting for their chance, waiting for their moment, waiting for the time when they no longer have to comply or obey. And they have submitted themselves, and there are, again, the prophecies of the millennium show the goodness and the abundance and the blessings. But there is a thread running through, and you can find it in a few different places that remind us. And it's because of what those sacrifices portray and how the temple was made and the reason for the walls and the separation between the clean and the unclean, sin will continue to exist among the people in that day. And all Satan has to do is come back and says, come on in. You've been waiting. And he has a rebellion fully in place. I think it's amazing when you just look at the concept of history as God portrays it. Prophecy is hard sometimes in various ways, and there are things in prophecy that we're only going to understand once it takes place, and then we see what God's hand was. But there are people, there have always been people, who simply do not want what God has to offer. In the Old Testament, in the current time, and in the time to come. Sin continues on down through the history of man, and it will continue on down into the millennium. Some people submit, but they never truly change. The binding of Satan is not the removal of sin. The removal of sin is only by the atoning sacrifice of Jesus Christ.